It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about the rise of drone hobbyists.
First, though, the U.S. Senate is set to vote on ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would federally ban bias in the workplace based on sexuality and gender identity.
With some Republicans backing the bill, more senators coming out in support of it today, ENDA appears to have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate.
The bill will still face hurdles in the House before any possibility becoming law. Speaker John Boehner has voiced his opposition.
Gay rights did make news in the House today, though, with Representative Michael Michaud of Maine saying he's gay, becoming the seventh member of Congress to be openly gay, lesbian, or bisexual.
Here with us now to talk about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act is New York Times congressional reporter Jeremy Peters. Jeremy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So it looks like supporters are feeling pretty optimistic going in. How would you say it looks right now in the Senate?
Well, for the bill to clear this first hurdle, it looks like the supporters are guaranteed a victory. Now, of course, this is only the first step in what is going to be a multi-day process that will take us into the end of the week. But barring any kind of unforeseen troubles, it appears that the bill will overcome the filibuster by the end of the week and become law. That is one thing that is quite uncertain. If this clears the Senate, it of course then would be it would need to go to the House in order for it to become law, and that appears highly unlikely at this point because of Republican opposition.
Now, we've seen this kind of legislation before. In the past, it has failed, and it seems as though this time the difference is that there is Republican support behind it, some of it up front, some of it sort of behind the scenes. Tell us a story about how that Republican support is playing out this time.
Well, it's been fairly muted, I would say. You have a handful, really. Four who came out prior to this weekend. Today, you had a fifth, Senator Dean Heller of Nevada, who said he would vote for this. Now, remember, that's only five of 45 Senate Republicans. It's not a huge amount, and it by no means points to any sort of overwhelming support in the Republican Party, at least it's contingent in Congress for gay rights legislation. Now, the people who have been working this bill on the Republican side, Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Mark Kirk of Illinois, of course, represent rather moderate states. So I think when you look to places kind of elsewhere in the country, states that are redder politically, this remains something that Republicans are very wary of supporting.
I've heard that there is some support, possible support, I should say, behind the scenes, Republicans who aren't declaring themselves. Are you seeing evidence of that, too?
I'm told that, of course, nobody wants to say, who has given them private assurances that they will vote for this. I can tell you, though, that gay rights supporters and sponsors of the bill in the Senate are pretty confident that they will get at least a handful more, that they could have somewhere in the order of, six or eight Republicans who ultimately vote for this. And they have their sights set on Rob Portman of Ohio, who came out earlier this year in support of gay marriage after learning that his son is, in fact, gay. And then you have Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, who also seems to be somewhat persuadable on this. Now, others that are probably a little bit less likely to go for it but have not been written off are John McCain of Arizona and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania.
Now, what arguments are the opposition making right now in terms of why they're still voting against it?
Well, that's interesting, because what you don't hear is a lot of the rhetoric around these battles that you would have heard 5-10 years ago. There's almost no condemnation of homosexuality, at least among those in the Senate. Republican senators are being very careful not to make this an issue of moral judgment. What they are doing is saying this bill will open the door to frivolous lawsuits and be a trial lawyer's bonanza. So that's the route that they have chosen to take rather than kind of going in a more religious direction.
Now, it seems that there still are some misunderstandings, reading, for instance, the New York Times today, people talking about employers having to pay for sex change operations, for instance, or, say, a Christian school having to hire someone who cross-dresses for that school. These are the types of concerns and misunderstandings that are still apparently dogging this process. Where would you say they're coming from?
Well, I don't want to leave you with the impression that there are not elements out there that are trying to make this an issue of homosexuality. There are religious conservative groups like the Family Research Council and others that are saying things like outright distortions, saying that this will allow children to be taught by men wearing dresses, or that this will allow pedophiles to be protected under the law. So there is that certainly happening. It's happening on the margins, and it's not something that I think a lot of people in the Senate on the Republican side are taking very seriously.
Now, it sounds like some Republicans have been concerned that if they didn't support this legislation, that the Republican Party would, you know, look out of step with the way that the country as a whole is feeling. Is that sort of what's driving the Republican support that we're seeing so far?
I think that's part of it. But, you know, when you look at the numbers, there are still 40 Republicans who are not sure that this is a good idea. So I don't know that they're all that concerned about looking out of step. I think that what the Republican sponsors are saying is this is an issue of fairness, and it's just kind of about time that they finally added gays, lesbians, bisexual people, transgender people to federal non-discrimination law. I mean, I think if you were to ask most Americans, are gay people protected under federal law, they would say yes, and that is not the case. It's not the case in 29 states, in fact. And so I think what you have more than any political calculation is really just a recognition that this should be done. It's a relatively straightforward law. It's not something that is as politically risky as, say, same-sex marriage, which, you know, interestingly enough, some of the Republican supporters of this bill do not support. Susan Collins of Maine, who has worked very hard to get people on her side of the aisle to support this, is not a supporter of same-sex marriage, but yet this is one issue that she has taken up very passionately. So there still are a lot of reservations around other gay rights issues in the Republican Party.
Do you have any idea how many states already have laws similar to End on the Books right now?
21 in the District of Columbia.
So is that, you know, part of why the support is there now as well, that this is something that, you know, a lot of people are already seeing in their states?
Yeah, because when they ask their constituents about this, their constituents assume that it's already the law. So I think for a number of them, they just don't see any political downside in doing this at all.
And what do you expect to happen as it starts its movement in the Senate?
Well, I think today it will be a first real test of how much Republican support it will have. We know, or at least we think, it's going to get the 60 votes that it needs. It has now five Republicans who are on record as supporting it. It will be interesting to watch how many more, if any, come around. I know that supporters of the legislation feel optimistic they can get a handful more. And that could be a signal to people in the House of Representatives who might be wary of supporting this over there. Now, it will be very difficult to get this moving in the House. It's the Republicans control everything over there. It's unlike the Senate, which is controlled by Democrats. And the Speaker, John Boehner, came out with a statement today saying that he is opposed to this legislation because he believes it would open the floodgates to lawsuits. So supporters of this legislation in the House hope that there is some backdoor way that they can slip this into a larger piece of legislation like the Defense Authorization Act, which will have to come up for a vote before the end of the year. Whether or not that happens, I would not bet on it at this point. It looks like a pretty difficult task. But still, regardless of what happens in the House, the Senate action, assuming that it ultimately passes in the Senate, will be significant because the Senate has not voted on a non-discrimination measure that includes gay people since 1996.
It's been a while. Well, we'll be watching it, and I'm sure you will too. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jeremy Peters, congressional reporter at The New York Times.
Coming up after a look at the headlines, we'll be back to discuss the rise of drones as a hobby. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network.
Our next guest says there's a new movement on the rise. People are building and flying their very own drones, and it's a glimpse of what life might be like in the coming years when these small flying robots take over the skies.
Joining us now is Tara McKelvey. She's features writer for the BBC. We have a link to her piece, The Rise of the Drone Hobbyists, on our Facebook page. Tara, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So we've seen drones all over the international news, but how new of a phenomenon is recreational building of drones?
They've been around for a while. I mean, one of the questions is, what do you call these things? Uh-huh. Sometimes they're just, you know, model airplanes. But because, you know, drones have become so much, such a big story in the news that people call these model airplanes, they call them drones too. So they've been around for a while, since you were a kid probably.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the same thing as a remote control airplane, essentially.
That's right. I mean, people who, you know, follow this field are very particular about the terms, but for the layman, drone can cover all of it.
So drones gotten kind of a negative connotation sometimes. It's something that is used for military purposes, spy purposes. What are some of the positive things people are doing with these off the battlefield?
Well, I mean, they can do all sorts of things. They can deliver a burrito. There's been a video out that shows them dropping a burrito and, you know, and journalists are dying to get their hands on them. Some journalists are using them now because they can do stories about weather and things like that and send the drone off into an area that's pretty dangerous. And also, like, real estate agents want to use them so they can look at property and make a better sale.
So what is the appeal to these hobbyists? It sounds like people are pretty passionate about them. It's not just localized to the United States. What is it that people are really enjoying and feel passionate about drones for?
I mean, I think, you know, it's cool. You know, you can make this thing go wherever you want it to go. And the videos show these amazing scenes where the drone's, you know, going in all these places, like around the Statue of Liberty. And you can pretend like you're, you know, flying in this crazy place that you're not supposed to be. So it's like a sneaky thing that you can control.
Well, that's an interesting question to bring up. If they're in sneaky places, if they're not supposed to be there, do people get into trouble flying these things around?
Well, there was a story of a woman who lives in the Pacific Northwest who said that there was a drone hovering outside her window. So it seems kind of creepy, and she complained. She wrote on a blog about it. So there's always that possibility.
Interesting. Well, has there ever been, you know, a sort of security flap over drones that we know about?
Different authorities, you know, across the country have different levels of comfort with these things. Sometimes they get pretty upset. Some of the drone enthusiasts who fly them around have gotten in trouble for them. They've been threatened with fines and so on because the drones have flown around. Like at University of Virginia, they flew around some buildings there, and the people who live there, the authorities, got pretty upset.
If I wanted to get into this hobby, what's my cost of entry? Is this a wealthy person's game?
No, it's cheap. You can build your own drone for about $500, but it's a pretty simple model. And also remember, there's a difference between these drones that you can build for cheap and that you can fly around your backyard, and the drones that do hard work, like the kind that a realtor would want or that a journalist would need. They're a little bit more sophisticated.
Now, we've been talking about some of the security issues, and the United States has been, with good reason, a little bit jumpy about airplanes in general in the last 10, 12 years. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, are there safety implications here just in terms of what a drone could do aside from privacy? You know, could it be something that was used to carry a weapon? Is it something that could injure the user as well?
I mean, both are true, that the weapons require like a pretty sturdy drone, and they also require a whole bunch of people to man it. So each of the drones that are used for Pakistan and other places where they're actually killing people, they have about 160 people behind them. And then the software is really complicated and sophisticated. So the idea that somebody could just sort of, you know, piece together a drone that's going to go out and kill people seems pretty unlikely. And that's also a question about proliferation. People are always worried that some kind of another country is going to get it and use it against us. But again, it requires a real outlay of resources. So it's not anything to worry about right now.
And what about the people who fly them themselves? Could they get hurt?
Yeah, I mean, they seem benign, and it seems like a lot of fun, but just, I guess a couple months ago, there was a guy in Brooklyn who got killed by one of them. It ended up hitting the top of his head. It was pretty horrible. Mm. You know, it doesn't happen very often. It may be one of the only cases where it's happened.
So what, I imagine there's a variety. I can picture a model airplane flying around, but what do some of these different drones look like?
I mean, they're, you know, like, they don't look all that sophisticated. They just, you know, like, they're just like these clunky kind of metal, all kind of, whatever, taped together, you know. The sophisticated part comes in how they're controlled, you know, the software or the you know, the controls that they carry around. But even, like, the really complicated ones can still be carried. You know, like, when I was in New York in Washington Square Park, one of these guys was just carrying his drone around. Lots of people were carrying their drones around, and it looks cool.
Well, your piece suggests that in the coming years, there's going to be a lot more drones, that they could be as popular as smartphones. What kinds of things do we need to do to prepare for a future like that?
Well, I guess learn how to work them, or, you know, it would be a start. But I think one of the problems is that they're not very, you know, there's problems with the navigation. They crash all the time. I mean, the military drones go down pretty regularly, and these little ones just crash all the time. So they have to figure out a way that they can fly through the civilian airspace without smashing into other airplanes.
Did you get, when you were investigating this story, did you get to try flying one or watch someone else operating them?
Well, when we were in Washington Square Park, there was a guy who was flying his own drone. And the person I was with, like the drone expert, it was kind of sweet. I mean, he was watching him, you know, like the way you'd watch a little kid in a playground. You know, he's sort of like in the beginning stages of drone operation. So, and they, you know, I've seen them fly around before, and I've seen the big ones, too, though I haven't seen them in the air, just on the ground.
In terms of, you know, whether or not there's going to be a next generation of drones, you know, we talked about how they're pretty much model airplanes, but how have they changed, and where are they going in terms of sophistication?
Well, there are lots of hopes for them in terms of their commercial prospects. You know, people are hoping to cash in on them, and that means making them more reliable and also probably being able to carry small things. You know, again, like delivering stuff would be like a really nice thing for drones to be able to do. But making that reliable is kind of, it's still pretty much in the future because there's too many problems with the design.
So I wouldn't, if I wanted to build and make my own drone, $500 does sound like kind of a lot, and I'm pretty technically inept. But assuming I decided I could overcome those hurdles, where would I even go to get one of these things?
There's lots of places you can go online. They have different, you know, parts you can order, and there's all kinds of instructions and things like that. I mean, it's a whole world. You know, these people go out on the weekend, they fly their drones, and then some of, like, the more entrepreneurial ones will go off on their own and do these crazy stunts. But it's, you know, there's plenty of people who would be able to give you advice on it.
Well, what about what the drones will, I guess, cost in coming ages? If they're $500 now, do you see them getting, you know, to be pretty sophisticated, something that you need to have more money to do?
Yeah, I mean, the cost will, you know, at the more elaborate level, the cost will also go down. So you'll be able to have one that can do stuff that will supposedly make your life easier, and it won't cost that much. But, you know, it's a tool, and it can be used for good or for bad. And also, there's something to be said for being actually in the place yourself rather than sending a drone. You know?
How far can they fly?
It varies. I mean, the big ones like the Reaper or the Predator, they can fly for hundreds of miles. The little ones just go, you know, a mile or so, or some of them can only fly a few feet before they crash.
Wait, so the recreational drones can go hundreds of miles?
No, the big ones, like the Reaper or the Predator.
Okay, gotcha. So the little ones are smaller.
Yeah.
That makes more sense. All right.
All right, Tara, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you.
That's Tara McKelvey. She's a features writer for the BBC. Now, Veronica, I know a lot of our listeners are crafty maker types. I'm wondering, if you're out there and you've made a drone, you've built a kit and fly it around, go to the Central Time Facebook page, if you would, and tell us about it, or better yet, give us a picture or maybe a video you did of a flyover of your neighborhood. Over that's Central Time on WPR. Just wondering if there are any drone hobbyists out there.
Or they could fly one by Vilas Hall right now. We can see it on our window.
Only if they bring a burrito. Or donuts.
Burrito.
They're lighter than the average burrito.
All of that sounds good. Well, you can go ahead and do that on the Central Time Facebook page and, you know, drop us a comment about other stuff while you're there, too. We always appreciate hearing from you. Well, coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about the rise of niche online dating and what it says about our society.
We'll also celebrate 10 years of StoryCorps, this group that goes around the country, helps people record stories of friends, relatives, influential figures. We'll have founder Dave Isay. He's going to be here to share some of his favorite stories, and we'll have clips. Over the years, I've heard some amazing stories from StoryCorps. I'm really looking forward to that.
And we'll find out why states are running out of options when it comes to administering the death penalty. Could it mean the eventual end of capital punishment in the United States?
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at a prison rehabilitation program focused on raising pheasants. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Vicker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's pheasant hunting season once again in Wisconsin.
But you might be surprised where some of the birds come from. In today's Wisconsin Life segment, producer Seth Javag brings us a story.
Back in May, roughly 5,000 newborn ring-necked pheasants were trucked from a state-run hatchery in Poinette to Oregon Correctional Center, a minimum security prison in Fitchburg.
This year they were born like at 10 o'clock in the morning and we had them at noon. So as soon as they're hatched, they load them up in a truck and bring them to us.
That's Prison Sergeant Rick Davis. He supervises the prison's pheasant farm, which helps the State Department of Natural Resources stock public hunting grounds.
We have two inmates that work with them constantly. They go down, they make sure there's water in there daily, and then there's feed bins in each one. Our pheasant guys are both there 42 cents an hour. That's what they get paid. Before they committed their crime, they were both kind of outdoorsmen and hunters and fishermen. It was no problem for them on any of this stuff, so they kind of knew what was going on.
For 5 months, the well-fed pheasants live in open-air pens about the size of football fields, enclosed by chicken wire and overhead nets that protect them from hawks, coyotes, and other predators. Each October, however, comes a reckoning.
Well, hunting season opens tomorrow. That's why it's a big day today. You want to get as many out there as you can for the opening of the season. They're picking up 660 pheasants today.
So how do you round up 660 pheasants in one day?
I think you'll be kind of impressed about how we do it. It works pretty slick.
Not happy, are you?
Here's how it works. Wearing gloves and protective glasses, a half dozen inmates enter a pen, fan out, and march toward the birds with their arms spread wide. The birds are herded into a small enclosure, the door shuts, and they're picked up one by one and stuffed into wooden crates that hold 20 each.
Let me catch these ones.
One, two, three, four.
Well, that's basically how you do it. Once you get them in there, you grab them however you can because they really don't want to be caught. You know, it's just like you said with the chickens. They're flying around.
There are some hazards to the job.
Hey, one on the back. One on the back.
Huh?
You pooped on me?
Yeah, he pooped on you.
Are you serious?
Easy, buddy, easy.
Pooped on my back.
When the crates are full, the pheasants are loaded onto pickup trucks driven by DNR staff and driven to places like Hook Lake Wildlife Area in Rutland. Here's Andy Polios, a wildlife biologist for the DNR.
So we'll open the crates and the pheasants will fly to freedom here out in the wildlife area, and hopefully enough of them will stick around for a day or two so that the hunters can have some good hunting tomorrow.
Their prospects aren't great, Polios says. If hunters or predators don't get them, the winter probably will.
So I better get out of the way here. There they go.
But for a brief moment at least, they're free.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can get more information at wisconsinlife.org.
Here to tell us more about some of the rehabilitation programs for prisoners across the state is Seth Javag. He's a freelance journalist in Madison. Seth, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
So I've got to ask first, did you get protective gloves and goggles?
You know, I didn't. I just kind of kept my distance. I walked behind them, and I felt all right about that.
All right. So you explained it some in the piece there, but how does this pheasant program work?
Well, there's a state game farm in Poinette, as I said in the mm-hmm. piece, and they raise tens of thousands of birds there. And they actually, the state game farm distributes them around the state themselves with the help of the DNR. But there's two prisons in the state where they send these new hatchlings to. It's one in Oregon and one in Oneida. And so basically, you know, the inmates raise them for those 5 months. And then when they're ready for, you know, they're fully grown, they take them out and onto the hunting grounds.
And they raise them from chicks.
That's
or,
right.
Or from eggs. I don't know.
Right. Well, they get them just after they're hatched. Like you said, it's like 2 hours old and they're moving in the van.
What's the job like for a prisoner doing this? What do they do over these 5 months?
Well, yeah, there's two guys that did most of the work, and they have to do a lot of making sure the enclosures are okay, like the nets don't have any holes in them. There's a lot of mending that they have to do. Of the fences, the same thing. They got to keep them watered, got to keep them fed, and you know they have to make sure when they're newborn, there's a lot of work to do to make sure they're not getting suffocated, like crawling on top of each other and things like that. So
one of the most famous prisoners in American history was, I don't know his name, but he was known as the Birdman of Alcatraz, who you know, spent his time taking care of pigeons, I think, at Alcatraz. Why is this done? Is this making birdmen of Oregon? Are we seeing a benefit for them in terms of rehabilitation?
Well, I think there's two things. One, for the state, it saves them some money from the state game farm. You know, it's, I guess, cheap labor, and so it's a money saver there. For the prisoners themselves, you know, they try to have employment for them. This is a minimum security prison. The guys who are in this particular facility are usually right on the end of their time served, and they're about to be transitioned back into the community. So this is another kind of job for them, you know, to get them ready.
Is this looked at as a pretty good gig for a prisoner?
Yeah, the two guys that were running it said they really liked it, and I think they like being outdoors all summer. You know, it's interesting work, and I think they liked it a lot. Yeah, it was pretty good. I think the ideal gig is to have, you know, release out into the community. A lot of people have jobs out there. They get paid more, but but I think the guys at the liked what they were doing here.
And what other rehabilitation programs are there like this? I've heard of farms and food-related things at prisons as well.
Yeah, a big one is gardens. There's a lot of prisons that do gardens. I know one just up the street from Oregon Correctional Center, Oak Hill. It has, I think, a four-acre garden where they harvested something like 80,000 pounds of produce last year, which is then is cooked up and used to feed the prisoners. And that's pretty common. They also have a state farm right near the Oregon facility there where inmates from Oak Hill milk cows and, you know, grow crops. And again, that food is used throughout the correctional system.
Is there a sense that this is just something to do to keep prisoners busy or that, hey, there's something really particularly valuable in this kind of outdoor agricultural or ecological activity?
Well, I guess I didn't ask that question specifically, but I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's, you know, it is, like you said, something, it's a job there that's useful. And yeah, it's nice to have something, like I said, outside. I think it's the same with the gardening that, you know, it's if you can spend the entire summer outdoors working on that stuff, I think they like it.
Now, I got to know how you fell into this this idea, because I imagine most pheasant hunters out there, or maybe they do know this, I'm not a pheasant hunter, but I would guess they wouldn't have a clue that these pheasants came from the local correctional institution.
Yeah, I had actually driven past it a number of times on County M there, and when I first saw the nets, and it's quite large, I was like, is that a ginseng farm or something, you know? and I just got curious, and then I had asked about it this summer and found out, oh, they're raising pheasants. And yeah, I think it's somewhat unknown, but yeah, it's been going on a long time. I talked to the guy at the state game farm earlier this year, and he thought it had been as long as maybe in the mid-80s they started it up.
Is there any thought of expanding this, or does the state have the pheasant population it needs?
Well, this year, I think it was 78,000 pheasants were raised at the state game farm, which is quite a bit. More, I think last year was 54,000. So they're kind of, I don't know if that's an ongoing trend, but they did say this year was a lot more. Whether or not they're going to expand it further at the prisons, I'm not sure. I know Oregon got more this year than they had in the past, so...
All right. Well, Seth, thanks a lot for taking us on this look behind the scenes.
You bet.
That's Seth Jovag. He's a freelance journalist in Madison.
Up next, we'll learn how jellyfish are taking over the seas and what that could mean for our fishing industries and the health of our oceans.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in the next hour on Central Time, we'll talk about efforts being made in Wisconsin to address mental health treatment.
First, though, we take a look at the seas and one creature in particular that's taking over.
Jellyfish have no brain, they're mostly water, but they're swarming coasts around the world and wreaking havoc on fishing economies, tourism, and even clogging nuclear cooling systems.
Some jellyfish stings can even be deadly. But why are they spreading now?
Well, here with us to talk about jellyfish blooms, as they're called, is Gwen Guilford. She's a reporter and editor at Quartz. Her recent article in Quartz is called Jellyfish Are Taking Over the Seas and It Might Be Too Late to Stop Them. Gwen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks.
Can you give us a sense of just how big a problem jellyfish are in the world today?
Well, the biggest problem probably is the fishing industry. Every year, jellyfish blooms wipe out about $100 million in economic losses in Japan, and that's where they have the biggest jellyfish in the world. They're like the size of a telephone booth, and they weigh about 440 pounds. So huge explosions of their population make it so fishermen can't catch any fish. So when things like that happen, you know, you see hundreds of millions in economic losses, and that's not just in Japan. That's happening, like, in the Black Sea. Jellyfish wiped out a $350 million a year fishing industry. And that's happening in off the coast of Africa, too. It's all over the globe, really. So that's one of the ways that they're having a big impact, a big economic impact. Also, you know, anytime they clog a cooling system like they did in late October in Sweden, a nuclear plant, there are going to be economic losses there, too. And then they're also making it really hard on the tourist industry of, say, the Mediterranean or off the coast of Australia, because where their populations rise, obviously people aren't going to want to go swimming. So those are just a few ways that they're wreaking havoc.
And do we know why we're seeing so many of them? Because it seems as though the jellyfish population has really been rising sharply. I think you said something like 62% growth in recent years. What's going on behind that?
One of the problems about this question, and I think a reason people are getting very excited and worried about it, is that we don't have any way of knowing, because we don't have enough data, how big this problem really is, whether it's even happening. It's controversial. There are some scientists who say increasing populations of jellyfish are cyclical. So, but what you just cited, research by this marine biologist named Lucas Brotz at the University of British Columbia, he found that in a majority of, in 62% of major marine ecosystems, jellyfish were rising either in duration of their blooms, intensity, or frequency. So we have a pretty good idea. We certainly have a lot of reasons, observable reasons, to think that they're on the rise. The question of why is probably the scarier one here. And so basically, in areas where there's a high degree of human activity affecting the marine ecosystem, jellyfish populations are increasing. What to make of that? Well, there are several factors that are probably behind it. For one, overfishing. So, you know, there aren't really that many predators that eat jellyfish to begin with, but among them are, say, you know, salmon, mackerel. When we overfish those, which we have done, jellyfish, nothing's eating them. Nothing's keeping their populations in check. So there's that. There's also pollution from fertilizers and sewage. When we pump that into the ocean, it causes this process that strips oxygen from a certain area in the sea. And fish can't live there, but jellyfish don't need that much oxygen, and their populations thrive. So, again, while we're wiping out fish, more and more jellyfish are able to sort of exploit these conditions. And those are just two of the ways. I mean, the one that I think is most fascinating is it involves coastal development. So basically, the way that jellyfish reproduce, and this is really crazy, it's like a two-step process. So instead of popping out a bunch of baby jellyfish, they first create a polyp, which is a little sack of potential baby jellyfish. And that polyp has to affix to a hard surface in order to eventually release the baby jellyfish.
And right? It sounds like human beings are doing their fair share to provide the jellyfish with yes. just exactly what they need to plant these polyps on.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, drilling platforms, boats, things like that. Even some scientists found polyps on a cellophane cigarette packet floating in the ocean. So, but once they're on those things, they don't just create the baby jellyfish, they clone themselves. So we're talking exponential growth here.
I know, I'm waiting to see them in a horror movie. I mean, they sound like they're sort of unfightable. I don't know, is there hope for getting rid of jellyfish when they're, you know, so hard to get rid of, so hard to stop breeding? What do we do to get rid of them?
That's a great question. Some scientists in South Korea invented robots to hack them up, which is a really bad idea because it actually prompts the creation of those polyps. So that's one way where, you know, that idea backfires. I guess jellyfish aren't maybe really the problem. They're kind of the symptom of the problem. And the problem here is the fact that we're overfishing and, you know, creating all these coastal developments and pumping all these nutrients into the ocean. So, you know, it's not, the jellyfish are doing their jellyfish thing. It's not, they don't have brains, as you said, like, you know, they're not infesting the waters in some nefarious plot. It's really just that we are creating ocean conditions that are just supremely favorable for them.
So it's our fault, but I have to say, reading this, it does feel like a nefarious plot on the part of the jellyfish. And looking at those pictures and the fact that some of these jellyfish grow as big as refrigerators, I mean, it's kind of alarming. You don't really realize. I always thought the jellyfish were sort of, you know, sort of benign, whimsical creatures of the sea. I've been to an exhibit at the Monterey Aquarium in California, which showcased them in gilt frames and made them look really lovely and attractive. And then you read about this and you realize that, you know, there's a potential for incredible destruction here, it sounds like.
Yeah, the refrigerator size, the Nemura jellyfish, I mean, it sunk a Japanese trawler that tried to haul them up in nets in 2009. Wow. and then the little, like, one of the most, you know, dangerous, one of the most venomous creatures in the world is this Irukandji jellyfish off the coast of Australia. It's about the size of maybe a AA battery when it's fully grown. And it can cause brain hemorrhages, heart attacks, like just the slightest brush with it.
And you don't know until 10 minutes later, it sounds like.
That's right, yeah. And so we didn't even really know about it until about 20 years ago. And I was just talking to a scientist who finished a study last week, well, it was published last week, who found that Irukandji are increasing off the coast of Queensland and they're going further south, threatening, you know, Australia's massive tourism industry that builds up around surfing. Surfing's really big there. And how do you keep these things out? You know, they're tiny. They're very hard to see. At the end of the day, we really just don't know very much about these things. So managing the jellyfish problem is very difficult.
So I guess in terms of, you know, what we can do, which is what we have to look at this point, it sounds as though we can work on repopulating natural predators like salmon and mackerel, and it sounds like we also have to think about what we're pumping into the ocean. But is that any kind of fix that will help in the next 5 to 10 years?
I mean, it's very difficult to say that those. I mean, we should probably stop doing those things anyway. So, it seems like overfishing is definitely it's causing a slew of other problems. So that is something we need to get on top of, and you know, the pollution problem of our waterways, that definitely needs to stop, but it's going to be very, very difficult because we eat so much seafood, and that relates to the fishing thing too, obviously. Aquaculture is one of the big causes of this sort of pollution, of these nutrients that cause the oxygen to be stripped from the water and create these dead zones. So, you know, anytime you're fish farming or farming shrimp, and 90% of that happens in Asia, where people are eating more and more fish as their disposable incomes rise, anytime that happens, we're just going to see a surge in that type of pollution. It's sort of unthinkable the degree to which that's going to increase.
So a lot of hurdles that we're going to have to surmount. Yeah. And then there's the jellyfish themselves. I want to freak people out any more than they're already freaked out about jellyfish. But you talk about an instance in your article where there's a dead jellyfish and it's hacked apart, and like it still manages to use that hacking apart to grow more polyps and more jellyfish. So even when they're dead, it seems like they're a hazard.
Yep. They're really marvelous, amazing creatures. It's been very fun to research them, although terrifying.
Well, what research is being done about the rise of jellyfish? Are we seeing a lot of money being pumped into this area right now?
Not really. Not that I've heard from any scientists I've talked to. But it's not, jellyfish aren't a priority for our, at least the U.S. budgets, perhaps in Japan.
Well, why not? Do you think people should be paying closer attention to this?
It seems, basically the jellyfish, again, like they're the symptom of this problem we're creating. And we know so little about why their numbers are rising, whether they're rising. By the time we collect that data, though, it's, finally we'll be able to say, yes, we know for sure that their populations are doing this or that. But by the time that happens, we're gonna be in hotter water if their populations are indeed rising. So, the two-pronged approach of probably reining in some of the ways in which we're affecting the ocean and, bumping up funding would be a good idea.
Are jellyfish themselves edible? Could we be helping by serving them up with French fries and tartar sauce?
Yes. Some jellyfish are... That's a very general yes. Some jellyfish are edible, and you'd want to eat them. In fact, in China, they're quite popular. There are sort of fisheries that have developed to fish those jellyfish. Oddly enough, their populations have been damaged by other jellyfish whose populations are exploding due to the dead zone that happens from the runoff of the Yangtze in China. So in theory, we could start eating them. There's some people who are proponents of using them for fertilizer and things like that. So, people are thinking creatively about this. But one big problem with jellyfish, particularly in the nuclear reactor situation, but also in fishing, is if you kill them, great. You have a bunch of dead jellyfish.
All right. I'm sorry. We got to leave it there. We're out of time. But Gwen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Gwen Guilford, reporter and editor at Quartz.
Stick around. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.